You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Octavio Solis, welcome to Token Theater Friends. It's such a pleasure having you here today. Just to get started, can you talk a little bit about what Scenes with Cranes is all about?
It's about the themes revolve around grief and rage that comes from loss. It's about the story revolves around a mother who's just lost her son to a traffic accident that nobody seems to have seen, but everyone says it's an accident, and she starts to wonder whether it is an accident. And so she does her own detective work in her own home, because she thinks it might have been a deliberate strike at her son. But it's really about how she can't cry. She's in trauma, she's in shock, and she wants to understand her own grief. And she can't let go of her son until she knows the truth, until she's ready to let him go. So he's there. He appears, and he's by her side all the time, and she guides him through some scenes in the past that she was not privy to. She is the only one who can see him. Her name is Lourdes Payan, and Nico is their son, but she's trying to deal with her own sense of loss, with her grief. I wrote this really before in 2019, before the pandemic, but it feels like it's coded with everything that we've gone through with the pandemic, with George Floyd, with all the loss we've endured, the people we've lost, the years, the time we have lost, locked away in our homes, and the kind of sadness that I think it's going to take a while for us to get over. So it has that on it. It's called Scene with Cranes because that's the title of the music piece that inspired it. I was listening to Jean Sibelius' piece called Scene with Cranes that he wrote for a play back in 1902, a play called Death, which was written by his brother-in-law. And later he just moved, took the piece and used it, refashioned it so it would be a standalone piece. He took the music from that and made a waltz, and then this beautiful piece that I just found so full of that loss and yearning. It's only later that I learned that the crane itself is a symbol for death. It's a harbinger of death, but it's also a symbol for rebirth and for birth itself. So it has a dual meaning. And I thought that was appropriate for the work. The piece didn't just inspire the play; it's in the play. It plays in its entirety, in its 6-minute entirety, at the end of the play, becomes pivotal to the action. So that's where that comes from.
Lourdes is a majestically heartbreaking character, and I couldn't help but be touched beyond, I wasn't expecting to be as moved but just reading it, because obviously I haven't seen a production yet. But she was so powerful. And I wonder, how does a character like Lourdes manifest to you? Like, how do you come up with someone like that who has so much pain and yet is so, I don't know, so human and so overpoweringly human?
I think I've met women like this, very strong, powerful women that are aware of their own strength, that are aware of the largeness of their emotions, who are epic in their joy and in their grief, and I can see them playing Hecuba or Queen Margaret in Richard III. Older, stronger women who are fighting for their children, or fighting for their nation, grieving for their nation. And I saw Lourdes as something like that. And also, it just I wrote it for Marisa Chivas, and I know that she's an actor of tremendous power, and so it was easy to imagine how Lourdes was manifested as a character on stage or as a character in my writing, because I had Marisa as a template. She was the model for it. In fact, I cast the play really before I wrote it. I wrote the play because I don't like writing outlines. I wrote the play as a kind of poem, really very, very, very quickly. It was maybe 12 pages long or something like that. And so I saw the characters that I needed. And then I wrote little monologues for them to audition with when I went to Cal Arts. And they auditioned with these pieces, but I never used any of those pieces. They were just to audition with. And then when I knew who the people were, when I saw these young people and I knew Marisa was going to be there, then it was easy for me to visualize the story in its full epic dimension. And then I wrote the play. So there's a lot of the personal investment of a lot of the personality and the rhythms of the actors that is also in the characters, because I had them before. It really was a wonderful way to work, you know?
Yeah, like you mentioned at the beginning, Lourdes has to do kind of detective work, and reading the play made me almost think that, you know, like I imagined like a whole like pulpy series where Lourdes gets to be a detective. So, and I wonder, you know, like, when you start writing a play and you have a character like this, how do you choose the path that she's going to follow? Like, why can't we have the Lourdes as a detective piece?
I think it's because how I choose that path, that's an interesting question, because I often don't choose the path. The character chooses the path. The way my whole philosophy is around trying to give the characters agency, giving them room to make their own decisions, kind of turning the reins over from me to them. And then I just write what they say and what they do. Even if they take me into blind alleys, dead ends, I still trust them that they'll eventually get me to from A to Z in a more interesting way than if I chose that path. And so I find myself not working so hard once I just let Lourdes and Nico tell the story themselves. They took me through it. I thought maybe the story was going to be more linear, starting all the way back when before the father had his stroke. But no, it started right at his death, at Nico's death, and then took me through a journey that took us back in time, that took us through some of Nico's fantasies, and then back to another period just 3 days before. And I said, it breaks the narrative structure in a way that I find refreshing, because I can get very easily bored. Like when I start to predict what's going to happen next. And even so, even when I started to know, oh, this is going to happen next, it would happen in such a unique way that I was satisfied and compelled to see, well, what is it? What is it? How is it exactly going to happen? I kind of give them the agency to take me on the journey. I don't take them on the journey. They take me.
How do you let go of them then when you're done? Or how do they let go of you when they're done? Like, I wonder if you have any sort of rituals to say goodbye to Nico and Lourdes after you're done writing the play.
Oh, wow. That's really good, because I have rituals for getting into that world. A kind of meditation, relaxation process that I learned from Maria Irene Fornes, who was my model. She was my mentor and my friend. I learned a lot about that process, about getting into it. But in my writing exercises, I take a process where I kind of follow the same process in, I follow the same process out. So that we feel like we entered into the cave and then we come back out the same way, or find another exit the other way, and do a kind of countdown back to the real world, you know, where we can wake up and go, okay, I'm out of the dream. I can take a break and go have some coffee. But when I'm writing daily over the whole play, and once the play is done, I haven't done that ritual yet. I don't think I'm going to do that ritual until opening night, when I really feel like I can celebrate his release. For the first time last night, I went to rehearsal without my computer, without my satchel, my bag, and my notepad to take notes. And I felt like I'm done. My work is done. I let go of the play. And so I was like a kid having fun. I ate a lot of chocolate, had chocolates there at rehearsal, and I ate a ton of them. And I was like bouncing off the walls. But it was because I was excited. I was excited because it wasn't my play anymore, because it was theirs. It belonged to them now. So I felt a kind of release, like, okay, you know, it's Isaiah's turn to kind of tell Nico's story. I'm not doing it anymore. It's fully his character. And we've come to the point in the process where they're telling me what they need from me. And now I feel I'm done. So I feel like part of that letting go process has started. And it's very satisfying. I don't think it'll be complete until I see the final performance on Saturday night. You know, we've been kind of with this play for about 3 years plus, you know, with me by myself. It's been four, but three with many of these actors, most of them. And we're only doing three performances. So it's an event. If people don't see it, it's gone. They're going to miss it. So we hope that in those 3 days, that something magical will happen that will make producers say, you know, bring it to my theater. Let's do it next year. I want this production. I want to take this production here. We hope maybe for some international festivals that we can take this play. They're saving the set. They're saving all the costumes. They're saving the lighting plot. Everything about the production is being saved so that we can transport it somewhere else at some point. Unfortunately, at Red Cat, they have it's a booking. It's a touring house where they present projects from all over the world, and they're in there for just that week, and then they got to get out and move someone else in. So we can't do an extended run there. We could have, I suppose, at Cal Arts, but this feels like an event to do it here in LA.
Knowing this, you know, how ephemeral theater is, why make theater knowing that you can't preserve it and keep it forever?
You know, that's a really, really good question, one that I've been grappling with for a while. when the pandemic hit and we shut theaters down 3 years ago, I was tired. I had been working on all cylinders, working on almost two premieres at the same time that were competing against each other. And I was just really, really tired. And so when theaters closed down and indefinitely, I thought, good, I could use a break. I could use 6 weeks of not doing anything, just sleeping. But then I started getting itchy and still theaters were closed. And then when they said it would be about 5 years before we'd get a vaccine, I got really depressed. I thought, well, I'm done. I'm in my 60s. What am I in 5 years? I might as well do something else. I'm done as a playwright. I might as well write poetry or novels or something, because how are we going to come back from this? And a lot of theaters have shut down in that period of time, sadly. And we have lost a lot of theater artists to COVID and to other things that are associated with the whole environment from depression and anxiety, which I have dealt with. And I also caught COVID and was very, very ill in December and January of 2021. But it made me question the fragility. It made me acknowledge, rather, the fragility of theater and us as theater artists. And we did what we could to kind of still keep active. We did Zoom readings. We're still doing Zoom readings. It was a way to kind of at least work on our acting chops and work on our theater skills and not completely give up, even if we couldn't be in the same room together in the same room. It's still no substitute for a live experience with a live audience in the house. And so when theater came back and audiences started coming back, I just felt relieved. At the same time, you know, it's still touch and go. If in some companies, if one or two actors get sick, the production closes down. Sometimes they don't have understudies. We did. We made sure that we had understudies, and they've been involved with the production from the very beginning. They've run their own blocking. They've run their own lines, and they're ready to open if they have to. They're ready to step in. And in a few times when some actors did get sick, not from COVID, but from colds or something, an actor would step in right away and they filled it immediately off book. It was remarkable to see just how wonderful these understudies and how prepared they were. But in some, even this year, there's been some productions that have closed early because people got sick or because the director got sick. In some, the director couldn't even be at their own opening because of COVID, because they caught COVID. And it's tragic. And so we're still, you know, I'm still counting down the days. I keep telling the actors, stay healthy. Don't go out. Don't go out anywhere. Don't see anybody. Lock yourself in your room. And then come to us. And even in our rehearsal room, we still rehearse with masks on. Especially if you're only sitting watching the work, you're required to keep your mask on. The actors can take them off when they're acting, but we have to, my director and I and the stage management team, we have to wear our masks to protect the production. And God help me if I should ever be responsible for my own production closing down. That would be a terrible cross to bear. But that's the kind of world we're in now. You know, it's going to be like that for a little bit more, less and less, because theater is just a little more frail than, say, sporting events. You know, they don't close down sporting events anymore. At all. Airports, you know, they're all open. Everybody gets on a plane and they don't all wear masks anymore. Not required to anymore. But in the theater, we're still really nervous about that. We don't want anyone getting sick. So we test three times a week with these home kits. I got my booster, and I even caught a really, really bad cold, and I didn't come near the actors for like 5-6 days. But generally we're doing well, but it is such a delicate form theater, you know. It's been with us since the beginning of time, and yet it's still so delicate.
Yeah, I mean, totally. Like the fragility of theater is the fragility of life as well. Yeah. And since you wrote the play before the pandemic, now I'm really curious about what did your characters teach you about grief?
Oh, gosh. Well, they taught me to forgive. Without reservation, the wrongs that have happened in my life in my childhood. They taught me that much. They taught me that it's difficult to grieve alone. You have to do it. It's almost like a tree falling in the woods. You have to share it. Grief is a community thing. It's a community event, and when it does happen that way, that grief is shared. The grief is a way of cementing the community around itself. So I've learned a few things like that from my own play. I wanted to say one more thing. I wanted to say something about the how grief also helps us to grow. It helps us to grow, and we don't let go of the losses that we have. They don't get smaller. They don't diminish. We just grow around them more. And I don't mean thicker skin. I don't mean that we have a shell or anything like that. It's just that they enable us to grow in spite of the pain, actually because of the pain, we grow more into more fully rounded humans. That's, I think, one of the chief lessons that this play is teaching me.
So we have all heard that when you as a child lose your parents, you're an orphan, and then how there's no word in any language for when a parent loses their child. And seeing with Cranes, it's not the first time where you've dealt with the loss of a child, and thinking about something like Sayama Cristina, for example. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a parent, but you're a parent. And can you talk a little bit about how I can only imagine, or I actually can't imagine, what it would be like to lose a child. So I wonder for you as a parent, if putting that horrendous fear and nightmare onto the page makes it a fear that's easier in some way to live with, say, you know, on a daily basis.
Yeah, I think it does. I've said many times that I can't trust happiness, because I'm always wary that someone's going to pull the rug out from under me. But I'm learning to revel in it more than I used to. And it is because I can channel all my fears, all my night terrors to the stage, and I can place them there, and I can study them, and I can go through that pain and the grief and the rage and the loneliness of those experiences as a coping mechanism for me. My daughter's a grown adult now, and I still fear for her. I still fear for her every day. But it also made me aware that my mother and my father fear for me. You know, if there's an earthquake in LA, that they'll call me in Oregon and say, "Are you okay? Are you all right?" Or if there's a fire in Oregon, and we get a lot of them, they're always concerned about, like, how is it? How is it going? But the roles have reversed a little bit. It's my parents who are the children now, as they're in their 80s. And I find myself being like the parent calling them and asking them how they're doing, how they're coping. The fear's transferred over, has reversed itself. And the concern, anyway, has now shifted so that I'm worried about them and their health. And I think my own daughter is doing that with me. She's concerned about me. But that's, you know, that's how it goes. That's how we deal with life. Theater is an interesting kind of beast, because it kind of prepares us. It prepares us for the loss and the pain to come, because it's going to come. We're all at some point going to die. And I think storytelling, story and theater and poetry and the arts are a way to kind of prepare us for the inevitable, which can be harrowing, but also beautiful, you know?
Yeah, they're also a way to, not be alive, but also like to become like immortal in some way, you know, like even after you're gone, Octavio Solis's plays will be produced and will be read.
Well, maybe, but you know, I can't count on that. I can't count on that because you know, there's a lot of great playwrights that whose names we may never know, because you know, they disappeared into a library that burned down a long time ago, or their works have been erased or lost, or they're just slowly slipping into oblivion. All we can hope for is that our audiences now will attest to our work, to the power of our work, that audiences will help complete that circle that we engage in when we tell our stories on the stage. I don't hold my breath for the future. You know? I can't. It's too much hubris, you know. But thank you anyway.
You're very welcome. There's such beauty and musicality and poetry to the way in which you write, you know, stage directions and mm-hmm. settings. And I couldn't help but wonder, you know, having those images live in your mind and then you put them on the page, how is it then to see a director and a group of actors and a group of technicians and a group of artists try to conjure these images? Like, do they ever, you know, I don't know if do they have to live up to what you imagine, or is there joy and wonder and beauty in seeing how they interpret them as well?
I don't think they've ever had problems with this, because the director has really he embedded himself deep in the skin of the play. He's really protective of his process. He's very protective of his interpretation. But he's doing the play, so I can't complain, you know, because he's, you know, he's interpreting it. He's giving himself the freedom to interpret it and protect that territory. I am also director, so I offer my ideas as a director sometimes. And he goes, thank you, Octavio, but let me try this. I'll remember that. We'll try that sometime. But let me just finish this. I haven't quite finished it. And then when he finishes the scene, like a day or two later, finishes directing, working out what he wants, I go, oh, that was better than my idea. Or he achieved the same thing that I wanted, but in a different way, a way that he could own and say, that's my directing. It's not Octavio's directing. And it's still Octavio's play. So I just found that really, really kind of satisfying. The actors, I mean, they really found the rhythms of the characters so well. Because they were, you know, sometimes they found that they didn't have to work so hard, because, you know, I would write Ruby with Stacia in mind and Stacia's rhythms. And so I, you know, when she struggled, I say, you know, just be yourself. It's you. It's kind of you. I was thinking of you and how you are the most grounded character in the play. You've already had, as Ruby, your grief. And so bring Stacia's own groundedness around grief and sadness into that. And she did, and she brought it beautifully. But I have been really in awe of the and wonder at how beautiful the staging has happened around my words, and they did it. They've executed everything that I've wanted, and showed me some things that I thought, you know what? I'm gonna write that into the play. So I'll say, what was it you said? What were those lines? And then I'll rewrite them so that they're mine. But I love the improv work that they do has given me a lot of information that is now either written into the play or has become the subtext of the play. Because a lot of these actors have been with this project since 2019. They've seen many drafts of this play. Maybe six or seven, I don't know now. Usually I do more, but maybe it's even less. But they've maybe five. I think I've done five separate drafts of this play. Usually I do like 10, and I'm learning some things about that. There's some material that ends up getting dropped in some drafts from the previous draft, and then they ask themselves, "Hey, isn't this part of this story?" And I go, "Well, not anymore, but you know what? You can use it as subtext." And it does become the subtext. They don't forget that. They don't forget those earlier drafts. So it's still in them. That's what's wonderful. But the thing, Jose, that I found really interesting is how, because I sometimes don't trust myself enough, I want to just tinker with the play because I have time. I want to rewrite more in the process, in the room. I had a dramaturg who made it her task to protect the play from the playwright. And she was terrific. She brought so much of her own wisdom to the script, saying, "No, it works. Trust it. It works. You nailed this about our culture, about our people. Trust it. It's there. And you don't have to mess with it." And at some point also the actors would do that. I'd say, "Oh, you know, the way you said that line was better than what I wrote. So I wonder if you could say that." And they would say, wait. "Your language is so beautiful. Give me a chance to memorize it right. And then decide, because I can give me a chance to make your language work." And so they also protected the play from me. And that was one of the big learning experiences for me as a playwright. Is how they, how I need to trust myself more, because these actors and the director innately trusted my play. Innately, they just automatically going, "Oh yeah, I get this," and I would second guess myself. And I think part of that is also because it's my first new play since 2018. You know, it's been some time, and my confidence was shaken. Because I thought it was, you know, finished as a playwright. And it's what I do. I don't write TV. I don't write movies. I don't do fiction. I don't write poetry. I'm a playwright. And my confidence was deeply shaken. I questioned my identity as a person, because I mistakenly just saw myself mainly as Octavio Solis, playwright, instead of Octavio Solis, husband, father, man, you know, son. And so I had a crisis of identity because of that. And I've learned to be better about that, more balanced. So that's why I was probably kind of shaken and wanted to really keep working on the play, trying to perfect it when, you know, it's doing its job rather well.
What about Octavio, the short story and memoir writer? Because I love Retablos so much. And although I would want to ask you a lot of questions about Retablos, something that was my favorite thing in the whole book, because it resonated with me. And I'll tell you a short story so that you know where I'm going. My dad growing up listened to Herb Alpert. And he would bring him up constantly. And up until I read Retablos, I thought my dad, Carlos, was the only person in the world who listened to her Valpert. And I was like, oh no, he exists beyond my dad's existence. And and in fact, like one of my proudest moments as a son was I was walking down the West Village once, right in front of the IFC Center. And there was this man selling, you know, old records. And I found this record and I remembered from when I was growing up, my dad describing a Herb Alpert album that his grandpa or his uncle or someone in his family had that had Herb Alpert, I think, or someone on a plane in the cover. And then I saw that record there and obviously I bought it. Like it was like the best dollar that I've spent in my life, because then I brought it to my dad and he was so happy because he couldn't believe that I had found something that that was lost to him. So can you talk a little bit about Mr. Alpert in your own life?
Yeah, well, Retablos, my sort of creative nonfiction book on growing up in El Paso, it came out of the blue, and I started remembering these stories, these little episodes, and I thought, I should tell a story of my life. But you know, I because I can't remember everything that happened in my life growing up, I can only remember episodes. I thought, tell my story in little short story forms, almost like little one page, two page stories, and that worked. It worked for me, and I wrote them completely out of order. But I could not resist writing about my life with my sort of discovery, really, of my theatrical self through Herb Alpert albums. My mother had them all, and I think she got them from my grandmother. She had the Lonely Bull, Tijuana Taxi, the of course Whipped Cream and Other Delights, Casino Royale. He put out so many albums and they were all, you know, really top selling albums at the time. And I loved that sound. It was a beautiful, fully fleshed out kind of pop Latino sound that was also interpretations. It was of American standards and a lot of movie themes. And I just loved it. I don't know why. And also, I thought he was, because they always showed him kind of dark skinned, I thought he was Mexican. I thought he was, you know, a Latino. So he was kind of a hero to me. And I emulated him, and I cut out a trumpet from a cardboard lid of a shoebox, and I colored it with crayon or marker. I think it was with all the staves and everything. And I would play that thing along with the albums. And my parents thought I was crazy. My brothers and sisters thought I was crazy. They couldn't relate to that. But it was my fantasy world. And I pretended I was Herb Alpert. It was kind of like my first, I think I was 10 years old. It was my first acting experience. But it was a fantasy that I was, that now I think is like really embarrassing. But at the time it was like, I don't care what anyone thought. I emulated this guy. And it's only much, much later in my adult years that I realized that he's from Romania. He's of Romanian descent. He's Jewish, and but he has supported a lot of musicians through the years through A&M Records and through scholarships. Actually, in fact, the at Cal Arts, which commissioned my play, there's a whole music building that's named after him, the Herb Alpert Music Hall and or music building, so he's contributed a lot and still does to the success of other artists, so I still greatly admire him. I still think he's terrific, but as a kid, to know that there was someone like that, even if I completely missed it, even if I was wrong, it told me that there's room for us. There's room for us in the world like that. Then, of course, later as I grew up, my heroes became Carlos Santana, you know, and Richie Valens, you know, and I discovered about him. And so it was, you know, I couldn't not write about that, because it was a way it was my way into the creative world, and also into my love of music. It was almost like the very first kind of awareness of music that I had before I learned about the Beatles, before I learned about the Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan and all these cats, the Mamas and the Papas and Joni Mitchell. I loved all these artists, but before them I was listening to Herb Alpert.
Did you ever toy with the idea of becoming a musician?
Yes, I have. I'm a frustrated musician. I even joined the band and I played cornet. I was emulating him. I thought I wanted to be that, but I did not want to wear my glasses. I didn't wear glasses at the time. I didn't know I was really nearsighted, so I couldn't see the sheet music. It was way over here, and I couldn't see it in front of me. So I would play like this, reading the sheet music with on the side like this, and blow the horn into the next guy's ear. And the teacher just said, "You've got to get glasses. You need glasses." And I didn't want to get them because I was a kid and I was very vain. So I quit the band. I quit band, and I sold the trumpet. Later on, I bought a guitar, and I wanted to learn guitar when I got my glasses, you know. And I've tried other instruments. I taught myself how to play the saxophone, except I don't know really how to play music on it. I learned how to make sound come out that was beautiful, but it wasn't, you know, I couldn't play along with anyone like that. It was fun though, and I even have a guitar here that, and I just am trying to learn, teach myself through YouTube videos, things like that, because I love music so much. And but the way in which I get to be a musician is by writing lyrics and plays. That's how I do it. I know how to write lyrics that because I hear the music in my head, and so I'll write it to a certain way. And then I'll pass the music on to a composer and they'll do something beautiful, but I can take credit for it because it's my lyrics and I had a hand in that. So it's about as close to a musician as I can come to be a lyricist. And I love that collaboration. I think that in some respects, I think that's why there's music in almost all of my plays. In this case, it's all instrumental. But in Quijote Nuevo, I wrote songs for that Ed Robledo and especially David Molina just turned into beautiful songs, beautiful music. And I hardly had to change a lyric in there at all. They would just say, "Can I repeat the line here?" And I go, "Yeah, yeah." So they just had so much fun writing to my lyrics. And the songs are stunning. And they're not the only artists I've collaborated with. There are many more. But in my most recent work, Quijote Nuevo, it was so wonderful to hear the kind of music that they did. And I felt like that's about as close to being a musician as I could come.
So have you mastered any songs on the guitar yet? Like even something short?
No. I think there was a Bob Dylan song that I learned the chords to, but I forgot them. I just haven't been practicing enough. It was I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine from John Wesley Harden. It's a great album. It's a great song. It was simple chords, so it was easy to sort of follow that. But I have to, I work on it for a while, and then I'll lapse for about 6 months and I forget everything. And so I have to teach myself everything all over again, you know.
So going back to retablos and memories for a second, I recently read an interview with memoirist Mary Carr, and I'm paraphrasing her, but she said something that really stuck with me. And she said that when people ask her, when they read her books, when they read her books, and they asked her, "How do you remember all of this?" And her response would be, "I don't, I just think I do." So I wonder when, you know, when someone in your family or someone in your friends comes up to you and they're like, "Hey, I'll tell you, this never happened," or "This didn't happen like this." How do you deal with that? How do you navigate that?
Well, the same way a fiction writer would. I was more interested in telling a story than in remembering things accurately. And because everyone will have their own version of what happened, of a particular event or memory, they will remember it a certain way. We will never reach consensus. So I said, I have to trust my own memory on this. Because I know that there's a core event that really happened, and I know that so well. The stuff around the edges are a little fuzzy, and I give myself permission to bring other memories to fill those in, or I make it up because I need a little bridge to connect between one truth and another. I just make up a little thing, so I feel like I gave myself permission to do that, permission to invent in order to get to a greater truth than just, you know, something that happened to me. There's a story. I want to tell a story. But all the events that happened, the main events that happened in Retablos are real. They did happen to me. I just gave, you know, they may not have all happened on the same day. I just brought them all together so that they would happen the same day, in the same way that Shakespeare did that with his history plays. You know, he just took things that happened 10 years apart and he made them happen like one day or the next day. They made it all happen like very quickly when they took a lot longer for them to occur. So that's interesting that Mary Karp kind of put it that way, because that's a really good thing. I think I remember it this way. I think that's really, really, really cool, because it's applicable here. And also, here's the thing, and I put this in the introduction to Retablos. Every time we remember, we revisit a memory of something that happened, we remember it differently because of who we are at the time we're remembering. We never step into the same river twice. It's always a different river because the water's traveling, the water's changing. So memory works that way. So we there's a patina of experience that we lay over that memory when we remember it. And if I go back to that memory 10 years later, it's going to have another patina over it. And so it changes. And every time I tell an event or I hear my parents tell a story that happened, I go, wow, that's not how I remember you telling it. You told me that this happened this way. And they went, no, it happened like this. I said, wow, you told it very differently. You know, when I was a kid, I remember you said this. And they'll go, no. So it's it happens to all of us. We remember. Our memories don't change. We do. We do. And so that affects how we remember, you know?
So although technically you're not a musician per se, if we thought of memories as notes and you're putting together all of these memories in a certain order, I think that kind of makes you like an arrangist, right? So that's kind of like being a musician.
yes, and truthfully, I craft my words very carefully, both in Retablos and in my fiction and in my plays. I take great pains, even though I let the characters talk and they talk how they talk, blah blah blah. I trust that language, and it sometimes it's poetic and sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's really profane, but then I'll look at it and then craft it so that it has a certain musicality to it, so that it fits in the music of the piece. Even if the words are, it's okay, mija. Even the simple phrase like it's okay, mija, can have a certain rhythm and cadence that fits in the music of the whole play. It doesn't have to be, you know, grand poetry or beautiful lyricism. It can be a real common phrase that, if used right, has enough of that melody to carry the whole play to carry the events of the play forward. So I do take great pains with the language, with how I hear it. And when I don't hear it right, I go, oh, that's not how I wrote it. That's not it. That's not the words are da 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 da. But sometimes if an actor has been consistently saying the line wrong, I get used to it and I don't realize he's saying it wrong until the stage manager corrects the actor and me. And said, they'll come to me and saying, you know, you keep saying this. That's right, right? And I go, yeah. You go, no, that's not what you wrote, Octavio. This is what you wrote. And I go, oh. So I'll say, all right, we'll correct them. But sometimes I'll say, well, I like his line better. Let's change the one on the script to reflect what the actor's doing.
I love it. Octavio, it has been a true pleasure talking to you. Would you like to invite our viewers and our listeners to come see your play?
I encourage everyone in the LA area to please come see Scene with Cranes. It runs from September 29th through October 1st, September 29th, 30th, and the 1st. Of October, and it's only a three performance run. There is an evening live stream that happens at 8:30, I believe that's Saturday. You can get tickets by going to the redcat.org website, and Red Cat stands for Roy and Edna Disney Cal Arts Theater. So if you go there, you can purchase tickets for the show. I'm very proud of it. And you'll see Scene with Cranes listed there. Okay, so thank you very much, Jose. This has been such a pleasant experience. Really, really lovely interview.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.